or excuse me, 724, Senate Bill 724. If any of you are here for Senate Bill 851, we will not be doing that today. Proponents of the bill have asked to move the date on it, so. Let's get the witness sheet here. We'll get going. Just also for clarity, as soon as Senator Menes gets here, I'm going to probably close this public hearing for a moment. We have invited testimony on Senate Bill 2000 or House Bill 2004, and we have Mr. Hartman here. So we will take a break and let Mr. Hartman come up for that part of the presentation, and then we'll go back into 724. So, first off, we have...
Senator Morissette is here.
Senator Morissette, which bill are you here for?
724, but I want to wait for everybody's here to testify.
Okay, that's fine. Then let's have John Steubenville and Christy Monson come up then.
Okay. I will come up too then.
Okay.
Go ahead.
You guys go first.
Yes, yes.
There's
something going on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Can you get started?
We're going to start with 7:24.
Okay, and then I'm going to go out in the hall and talk to my staff for 5 minutes, and I'll be right back in.
Okay.
I'll wait till we get started.
We will have interrupt this hearing to move to the first issue.
Okay.
You ready?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is John Steubenville. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. OLCC supports Senate Bill 724. We see this as a way to improve the local recommendations that OLCC very much values from its local government partners in the liquor licensing process. The bill before you today really is a result of an unintended consequence from a couple of sessions ago. In 1999...
John? Would you hang on just a moment, please? Just for the record, I'm going to let Mr. Ellsworth explain the bill.
Sorry.
I got a little ahead of myself.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, we're speaking about Senate Bill 724, and its purpose, it allows city and counties 60 days instead of 30 days to consider applications for issuance of new liquor control commission licenses before making any recommendations to the commission on whether a new license should be issued.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Stubma.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The legislation before us today really is from an unintended consequence from legislation enacted by the 1999 Legislative Assembly. That year, the Legislative Assembly enacted House Bill 2892. The main purpose of that legislation was to streamline the number of liquor license types issued by the OLCC. Some other provisions that were included in that legislation led to the timelines that were statutorily mandated for local governments to provide recommendations to the OLCC. And what you have today is local governments are given 30 days to issue a recommendation on a new liquor license, but 60 days to issue a recommendation on a renewal of a liquor license. Well, in fact, typically a recommendation on a new liquor license takes significantly more time to analyze because it's a new establishment. You have no history on the premise, and so because you have a new operator, it's just going to take more time for the local government to give it careful consideration. So OLCC supports this legislation, supports standardizing the timeline at 60 days in order to ensure our local government partners adequate time to give notice to their neighborhoods, their law enforcement personnel, and to fully consider the recommendation that's forwarded to OLCC. And with that, I want to thank you, and I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Welcome, Senator. We're doing Senate Bill 724. Christine, go ahead.
Actually, Chair Corcoran, my name is Art Hendricks. I'm with the City of Portland. I'm the Crime Prevention Manager, and I wanted to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify, and Christy asked me to go ahead and go. And I want to just add to the earlier comments that under the current legislation, with the 30-day time period that's required under ORS 471166, the local government has 30 days on new licenses and 60 days on renewal. And in a renewal period, we typically have a history already with that license, but we don't under a new license. And the importance, not only from an administrative standpoint, but also I'm here to represent the kind of a collective voice of neighborhoods, is that within neighborhoods, it's the one opportunity we have really to establish a positive rapport and get the relationship right between the new license and the neighborhoods. And 30 days currently has been prohibitive, both from an administrative standpoint, but from neighborhood associations. Typically what happens is they don't receive notice that there's going to be a new liquor establishment somewhere between 5 to 10 days, because there is about a 1 to 2 day period that we process the application within the city, and then there's time that the notice goes out in the mail. So typically a neighborhood will get it somewhere between 7 to 10 days, and then they have to mail it back, or in many instances they'll fax it back. And so it really gives neighborhoods about a 10 to 14 day window to be able to understand what is the type of operation, to understand what kind type of license it is, and to begin to start establishing a rapport and communication with the potential licensee. So what has been problematic, I think, since the new legislation came into effect, is that is just not a sufficient enough time for neighbors. And we, for the past year and a half, have heard neighbors talking about the difficulty for them to even bring it to their neighborhood association, because typically neighborhood associations meet like other governmental boards on a monthly basis. So it has created an extreme amount of difficulty for us to really be able to get the input from neighborhood associations and from neighbors who are around the license to hear what their concerns are. I think what's also important as the crime prevention manager for the city is that we are particularly interested in really trying to develop a cohesive relationship between that licensee and the neighbors. And one of the tools, one of the things that we often will do is try to have the business and the neighbors go into what's called a good neighbor agreement, which is a voluntary good faith effort to really talk about what are some concerns or issues that they may have, particularly when you talk about certain types of operations, mainly bars and taverns, or if it's a kind of a nightclub establishment where there's going to be a lot of patrons. Neighbors who live in close proximity have numerous concerns that are things that don't necessarily come up to the OLCC Commission, or when they do come to the OLCC Commission, they're things that can't necessarily OLCC can do anything about, like trash, noise, and things that at a city level we try to mitigate any potential problems. So we really feel that In all honesty, 60 days is really recognizing that there has to be some kind of limit, that we don't want to have an open-ended process. We do recognize the need to be fair for the businesses, that 60 days would provide a reasonable time period for the city to give notification to neighbors and neighborhoods and give us an opportunity again to establish a positive rapport and help facilitate a process that we have to remember, that in new licenses, this is the time where we get it right. because typically what happens is that once that license is granted, and if there's something that's been overlooked because information was difficult to get around the prospective owner, if there was just, say they were from out of state, there was information that we couldn't get about the potential operation, they may get that license, and typically they will have that license for a period of time, which creates both a lot of conflict in certain instances, and certainly becomes something that we, the city, really have to try to help neighbors live with. So we urge you to look at extending the time period. We believe that 30 days is insufficient for neighborhoods. It certainly is onerous for us on an administrative level, both law enforcement. We work closely with the Portland Police Bureau, who does the investigation. And most of that information on new licenses, if it's in-state or if it's something that occurs within this information is readily available, is not too difficult. But if it's out-of-state, it becomes very onerous, particularly if you're talking about multiple ownerships on a particular license application. So I thank you for your time and consideration on this issue.
Art, let me ask you a couple questions. Give me an example of the last time you had a problem with the licensing and the 30-day limit of a place that you would consider high risk.
Well, there's numerous examples I can give you. I think one example, let me just state that because we are dealing with, in some areas of Portland, where they've had a history of crime problems that may not be associated to a business, but a new business comes in and the type of operation, the type of product that they are going to want to sell raises red flags for the neighbors. So if it's a convenience store and they are wanting to sell fortified alcohol, what happens is that neighbors, and I need to remind you that many neighborhoods in Portland have been dealing with years and years of chronic crime issues, and they're concerned about the application is that are they going to be sensitive to the conditions within the neighborhoods. What we've had in some instances is that they'll agree in a good neighbor agreement that they won't sell certain kinds of products, but they get the license, and what ends up happens, they end up selling products anyway. They end up going into a situation where they in effect lie to the neighbors around what types of things they're going to agree to do about seating, about the types of operations that they're going to have operating within the business. Then what occurs from that point is OLCC certainly gets involved with their regulators, but there aren't necessarily things that sometimes in that things just come about in terms of ownership. So an example, there we have one operation where the manager of this particular nightclub has an extensive criminal history, and he was not the manager when the business opened up. He was the brother of the owner, and we have had numerous calls for service, numerous complaints from neighbors about how they manage the operation, the volume of alcohol it serves. So it's a multitude of things, and from our standpoint, what some of this can be mitigated with extra time, really to be more extensive in terms of the operations, as well as to really kind of work through some of those issues up front.
But Art, I guess getting back to your last example, the manager at the time of the application was legitimate, didn't have an extensive criminal history, and then his brother came in and had a criminal history. That wouldn't have made any difference, would it, 30 or 60 days?
In some cases it could, because I think what it does is it gives, and I have to also let you know that there are oftentimes when a license comes in, there is information that neighbors will bring forward that police or we, the city, don't even know about. And some of that may just be through conversations and people digging up information on their own. In some situations, no, it wouldn't mitigate that. Okay. But I think part of what happens is there's a human element rather than a bureaucratic element here, where if it's an operation's going into your neighborhood and you as a neighbor say, you know, there's really some things that this person's been telling me about the operation. I've been asking a lot of questions. We've really been working it out. I really think you need to look further into something. So in a lot of ways, neighbors hold we, the bureaucrats, accountable and really push us to say, look at this a little more closely, and this is something that's going to conflict with the character and the fabric of our neighborhood.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Do you support, are you testifying in support of the bill or the amendment or both?
Senator Starr, I'm testifying in support of the bill. I certainly, again, ideally 60 days from our perspective would be best. I think, most appropriate. In all honesty, if it goes to 45, it's something that I don't know if that's going to solve the problem. But from the neighborhood standpoint, 30 days is just unreasonable.
Okay. Thank you very much. Christy?
Thank you, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. My name is Christy Munson. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. I'll be brief. I just have 3 points. First, the process in developing this bill was a long one. It took a meeting of a task force, a governor's task force, 10 times. The members of this task force include people such as Senator Ted Farrioli, Senator Bill Morissette, Representative Betsy Johnson, Ron Dodge, President and CEO of the Hood River Distillery, Dr. Bob Gross, Cooper Mountain Vineyards, Brian McMiniman, and several people from the industry, including mayors and city representatives. This bill is a product of their recommendations. They recommended that we move to 60 days. My second point, what this bill does not do, it does not create onerous requirements upon business. If you are opening up a new restaurant or a new bar, I do believe that 60 days is reasonable to have us look at the history, make sure that you're on the up and up, make sure you're a responsible organization, and then create a really good working relationship with your neighborhood. I think that it was best said by a representative of the McMiniman organization during these meetings. He goes out and walks the neighborhood. He meets his neighbors. This is what we're trying to allow and create a better working relationship. So we believe 60 days will help that. Okay. Lastly, a couple of points as to why 60 days is good. You've already heard testimony here as to we need neighborhood input. Neighborhood associations generally meet once a month, if that, so we need to account for that. However, there's another reason. Some of these organizations are multi-state, multi-owner organizations, and it's pretty impossible to investigate these organizations within 30 days. It's darn near impossible to do it 45. My people have told me that 60 days is the bare minimum, and it's something they would really like to see.
It goes to 45.
Lastly, a couple points that aren't directly, but they're peripherally related. If a license is issued to a questionable business, it's very hard to rescind that or repeal it. We want to create a good working relationship, so we look at this 60 days as a preventative for neighborhood safety and for relations and to promote good business. That's all. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, everyone's talking about a new license, but as I read the bill, it's significant verbiage change here or addition includes renewal. So you're not just talking about new, but you're also talking about renewals, which I think is a different animal. And as I read the staff measure summary, it says new. As I read the description on the bill, it says new. Nothing anywhere except in the bill where it says renewal. And I don't know that anybody in their testimony has mentioned that.
Actually, they did earlier.
Okay, well, then I wasn't here.
Yeah, there's two standards, one 30 days and one 60 days. And I think the most succinct explanation is Mr. Steubenvall's right here, Senator. The bill enacted 2892 and 99 established 30 days for a new license and 60 days for renewal. So what these folks are proposing is to remove them both to 60.
I understand.
Okay. I'm going to Well, Mr. Perry's the only other person left. Oh, Senator Morsett, that's right. Okay, let's do Senator Morsett. We'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session or a public hearing on 2004. And okay, I'll get you out of here as quick as possible. We'll get Mr. Hartman up here. No. Come on up, and we'll do you, and then we'll get rid of you. And then we'll go on to another bill.
Before you open the public hearing on it, I thought you had discharges.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Phil Morissette, Senator from District 6. I wanted to hear some of the testimony. I don't want to recover material that they said, but what I do want to say is that my original bill in 1999 was to require that the OLCC follow the wishes of the local governmental jurisdictions in both issuing the license and the renewal. That didn't go anywhere, and so I changed it in the next session to say, unless they had compelling reason not to follow the direction of the local government, and that didn't fly either. So that second part was simply say that you will follow the direction of the local government unless you have a reason not to follow it. That was pretty weak. As a mayor in Springfield for 10 years, we ran into numerous problems concerning some of the local establishments. We had all kinds of problems. To the credit of the OLCC, they stepped in on several occasions, both at the invitation of the city and on their own, and shut some places down. I did testify before Senator Tiernan's committee about 8 years ago on this issue. It took me 3 days before I finally made it to the microphone. And they had a housekeeping bill that
could have talked all day and not made my day by mentioning Mr. Tiernan.
Okay, they did have what they called a housekeeping bill, which really would have eliminated the neighbors from having standing in a complaint, which was more than a housekeeping bill. Now, that brings the point to the neighborhood. And I think that there has to be a good neighbor policy there for a establishment to exist, and people do it in different ways, but I think it's important that we do have a 60-day period. There are such things as temporary licenses. I can't believe people wait until they open the doors before they apply, though. Seems to me that some of this can be done ahead of time. But in places like Portland, not Springfield, where they have neighborhood groups, which are characterized as kangaroo courts, Well, I want to make sure you're listening, Mr. Chair. I'm talking. Okay. But what I'm saying is I think the neighborhood associations do have standing, and during the committee that we have, the task force on OLCC, we had testimony from neighbors who were concerned about establishments that they had in the neighborhood, and I think they do need the time. 30 days is probably okay in some of the smaller cities, but where you have neighborhood associations that are only meet once a month to start with, and then they have to get their recommendation, they can't do it in 30 days. I think the 60 days is a reasonable request, and so I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate it. Anybody else on the witness list there?
Kerry?
Oh, Kerry's back. We'll let him do this.
Thanks, Senator. I'm sorry. I'm trying to unruffle feathers in the House. We're going to close 724 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2004. I'm doing this specifically. I wanted to let the committee know that I've handed out a copy of a request I made to Greg Chamoff and his response, which is attached to it. Some questions about 2004 and also 2003. Last, when we visited 2004 the other day, Senator Menes had some concerns about the issue of what what the PERS coalition had in mind in terms of their discussion over court challenges to contract rights. And so I've asked Mr. Hartman to come and speak to that. And Senator Menace, I thought peripherally, too, I would ask Mr. Hartman to speak to the issue of your concern that in 2004 that we not hinder the court's consideration of the Lipscomb decision. Is that a fair description of your concern?
Correct.
Okay. So I would like Mr. Hartman to maybe begin by just speaking a little bit to that issue, and then you and Mr. Hartman can engage in a dialogue in terms of the contract rights question.
Great. Thank you.
Go ahead, Mr. Hartman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for having me here. For the record, my name is Greg Hartman. I'm here representing the PERS Coalition. The brief handout I gave you really focused on the second issue, which was the contract issue. But let me say a few words about Judge Lipscomb, if I may. And it coincidentally, I testified on this issue before the House Committee yesterday, so it is an issue I've given some thought to. I appreciate Senator Menace's concerns. We have much of the same concern because we have a somewhat unusual circumstance in that we have a circumstance where Judge Lipscomb has expressed certain opinions about basically finding that in some instances the PERS board has misinterpreted statute, and some other instances he felt that they had abused their discretion. But because this came up in the context of an administrative proceeding, Judge Lipscomb did not have the authority to fix it, if you will. In other words, it was not within his original purview to say, I think you made these mistakes, and this is how we're going to fix it. And so his opinion stops short of how to fix it. What he did was send the matter back to the PERS board, back to the administrative agency, with some specific instruction to set aside orders having to do with rates for certain employers. But of course he gave a certain number of findings, and what's implicit in his order is that when the board gets this material, they will fix it consistent with the way Judge Lipscomb felt the statute should properly be read. Now of course Judge Lipscomb's opinion is on appeal, and we won't know for some time whether Judge Lipscomb got it right or part right or part wrong or whatever. That will work itself out in the courts. But one of the difficulties is not so much with interfering with the ability of that case to go forward, is keeping in mind that there is no remedy on the table right now. So, for instance, let me just give you an example. Let's suppose that the legislature were to pass House Bill 2004 pretty much in its current form. That would seemingly create the fix on the actuarial issue. So question, what happens, and let's assume that a year from now the Supreme Court says that Judge Lipscomb got that aspect of his opinion correct, that he in fact was correct, and that the board had erred in their understanding of what they should have been doing. Judge Lipscomb can't fix it. It still goes back to the PERS board. So you have to ask yourself, does your action by passing, you're the legislature's action by passing House Bill 2004, cut off the PERS board's ability to respond to whatever ultimately comes out of this litigation? Now, I'm not here to say that I have any specific recommendation or any specific suggestion on the best way to deal with this. This becomes a much more profound problem when House Bill 2003 comes over to you, again, assuming it's in its the form that it currently is before the House, because it is much more specifically the fix, if you will, for what Judge Lipscomb found to be errors.
Excuse me, Mr. Hartman, would that be the reserving aspect of that, or
in part, it really creates it takes what Judge Lipscomb found to be an error, it converts that to a dollar amount. Bill Gary, representing the local jurisdiction, said that was about $3 billion in his testimony yesterday. And then it creates a negative reserve within PERS, and then over time basically takes the earnings of the system to pay down that negative reserve. And so the point I'm making simply is that Judge Lipscomb's order is not self-executing. It's not like he gave a judgment for $1 million against somebody and you can go seize the property. There's another step in there, because before there can be a remedy, it has to go back to the PERS board for them to decide what that remedy is. So as you think about knowing 2004 and 2003, I think you have to think very carefully, are we leaving room for the for the purse board to act, yes or no? Is our resolution of House Bill 2004 and 2003 dependent on Judge Lipscomb being sustained? In other words, what happens if at the end of the day the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court says Judge Lipscomb got it wrong in some significant degree? Would the legislative remedy fall along with Judge Lipscomb's opinion? And again, I'm not saying that there's a right or wrong way to get at this. I'm simply saying that is a very complex issue. As I told the House Committee, literally last week I spent half a day with two of my partners trying to sort this all out and say, well, now if the legislature does this, how does that impact? So as you go down the road and consider these, it is a extremely important issue, and the best thing I can tell you right now is to try to have as much clarity in what your decisions are so that we all understand, is your action dependent on Judge Lipscomb, yes or no? Do you intend your action to have occupied the field, so to speak, yes or no? And I'm sure that by the time that House Bill 2003 comes to you, I may have a specific recommendation on many of those issues on behalf of the Purse Coalition, but it's really too early in the day for me to say one way or the other what our preference would be. But I think you've raised an excellent question, and one which has us scratching our heads, frankly, to try to figure out how this is all going to play out. So with that, let me turn to House Bill 2004 and the contract issues. And if I may, and obviously I'm here.
Can you hang on just a second, Mr. Hartman?
Mm-hmm.
So, Senator Menes, are you're comfortable then with that? I mean, I thought that was a good explanation of Lipscomb's interrelationship with whatever we're going to do here, whether it's 2003, 2004.
Well, it clarifies it to the degree that it's possible to do that, and I think Mr. Hartman pretty much encapsulates the difficulty in trying to track it. I do agree that it's very important for us to know, to whatever extent possible, what the enactment of legislation either does or may do with respect to the Lipscomb question, because and it troubles me in the discussion that the Lipscomb decision is on appeal. The board, if I understand correctly, has not done anything in the form of compliance with the Lipscomb decision with respect to the redistribution of resources, et cetera, et cetera. So that question is still outstanding, and I assume that would change many of the assumptions relevant to the gap.
If I may, just to bring you up to date and share some information with you, there have been discussions between all of the parties, including the state and Mr. Gary representing the local jurisdictions and myself, about the potential for a stay of Judge Lipscomb's order pending review in the court. It would be premature for me to say those are going to be successful, but we are thinking about what makes sense to happen while the appeal goes forward. And it's particularly difficult because we all know the legislature's acting, and the board can only act through rulemaking and adoption of orders. And given the timelines associated with that, it's entirely likely that this body will act really perhaps even before the purse board could act, even if they started today to implement the order. So we're all kind of looking over our left shoulders saying, you know, what's the legislature going to do, and does it make sense to attempt to move forward with or without a stay, because long before the purse board may get to the point of saying, all right, we now can go forward, the legislature may very well say, no, we think this is a better remedy, or this is the correct remedy, or we want you to do this, that, or whatever. So it is no one is sitting still ignoring Judge Lipscomb. Everybody's thinking about it. We're talking about a stay. Again, I don't want to represent that we will necessarily reach agreement, but we're attempting to. And trying to figure out what makes sense to implement, how to implement it, what makes sense to hold back, and again, taking into consideration that it doesn't do much good to go a couple months down the road and then have the legislature say, no, we prefer you to take another tack, because obviously it will, at this point, it will be the legislature who tells the board what to do, because it will be some time before we get resolution in the appellate courts, of exactly what part of Judge Lipscomb will be sustained or not.
Right. Interesting legal quandary. I mean, in one sense, you have a board that has specific statutory authority now, a circuit court opinion telling them to do one thing or the other. No stays in place currently. The board is, in essence, irresponsive, from what I can tell, on redistribution of funds. Now, assuming the board actually took the action and distributed the funds according to the Lipscomb decision, what I don't know as a legislator is what does that do to the forecast with respect to the future gap, and it assumes that Lipscomb's ultimately upheld in the Supreme Court. I'm saying all that to get to this question. I don't know what the legislature is really contributing to the discussion at this time. And that's what I'm trying to figure out, to the extent that we craft some wonderful new transitional plan or whatever, the fact that it is still subject to litigation, even more complex litigation, and this interplay with the Lipscomb decision, it just makes me wonder whether or not we're making, as a legislature, good decisions going down many of these roads. So
it's and again, I wish I could say there's one true path, but I don't think there is. I think the question that you're going to have to address is, again, do we want to put something in place and let Judge Lipscomb's opinion go forward and whatever potential remedy may come out of it go forward? Or do we feel it's more important to kind of cut across that and say, no, we've thought about these issues and we are going to act on our own authority, whether Judge Lipscomb got it right or wrong?
But Mr. Hartman, mm-hmm. and Mr. Chairman, the legislature did that when they enacted the existing statute. And that's where we got the discussion the other day about where is the contract. Mm-hmm. Where does it exist? Does it exist in statute, or does it exist in the decisions of the board that may be in violation of the contract, as Lipscomb asserted? So again, I'm just not sure that we're not creating Pandora's box by continuing to muck around with this thing, because it seems like the legal arguments get more complex the more pieces of legislation that we pass.
Senator Menace, and then I'll recognize Senator Walker. I guess it does raise the issue for me that if Lipscomb is here and the appeals court, it gets moved up to the Supreme Court, however, you know, the appeals court reacts. And meanwhile, we've constructed 2004 and 2003. Isn't it possible that if the Supreme Court had Lipscomb and these other pieces of the legislature's resolution to this, not the PERS board, wouldn't the court be free to look at those and speak to those as well, or would that require separate action?
Right now, the Lipscomb decision will be appealed to the Court of Appeals, and we do not have any direct appeal to the Supreme Court. We have all agreed to petition for direct certification to the Supreme Court, and we hope that the Supreme Court does take the case immediately, because obviously it's an important case. Assuming the legislature acts and you attach to your bill some form of expedited appeal, it's possible that those cases would arrive, or those issues would arrive at the Supreme Court at a close enough period of time that the court would say, look, let's put it all together and let's address everything, address Judge Lipscomb's issues as he addressed them, address the legislature's issues as the legislature crafted a solution, and consider it all at one time. That's entirely possible, but sometimes the timing on that gets real tricky, because I think if they both get there relatively the same time, I'm almost certain the Supreme Court would hold them and consider them essentially together. But, you know, if we miss by 6 or 8 or 9 months, and sometimes with litigation that can happen, it's possible that your issues could make it there before Judge Lipscomb ever makes it there, or vice versa. So it's a little hard to, I'm hoping to get there at the same time, to the extent there are issues, and therefore it makes sense for the court to sort it all out and tell us exactly what's going to stand and what won't. But it's a tough timing issue.
Okay. Now, Senator Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's what's boggling my mind, too. There seems to be a lot of hands in the honey pot. And I'm just not sure. I feel like the PERS board's been neutered, basically, in what they're able to do, because we're doing something, the court's doing something. How are they acting? What are they doing? I mean, I think that gets to some of the concerns that Senator Minnis raises, in that he says the PERS board is not acting. Well, they're kind of stuck.
you raise a very good issue. And for instance, just as an example, the PERS board, as I'm sure you're all aware, studied the actuarial issue for an extended period of time and was poised to act. As a matter of fact, we're about to enact their resolution of the actuarial issue. And I know it was taken off the agenda because of the sense that what the legislature was considering was different than what the board seemed to think was the correct resolution. So in a sense, you're right. It's almost like we've taken these issues away from the board, and they're sitting there waiting for the legislature to tell them what to do or resolution of the Lipscomb case so that they can move forward. So I think you're certainly correct to a certain degree. It has caused the board to be handcuffed, in a sense, or at least feel like they're handcuffed. So I agree. That's a good observation.
And it's a board in transition, which is interesting.
Well, that adds to the problem.
So should we get the contract rights? Would you like to?
Well, I'm not sure that we need to get there.
Okay.
I guess I'm in my thinking, and I think it's something the legislature is going to have to decide. Maybe we've already done it to some degree. And that is, do you just simply, as a legislature, ignore Lipscomb? Pretend it's not there, but recognize that it acknowledges a fiscal problem. And then legislatively construct a fix. The danger on that side of the equation is the exposure to subsequent lawsuits notwithstanding. And I think that's the issue that is really problematic for me, is whether or not we can construct a methodology to minimize suits and maybe perhaps expedite any suits in process. I don't know that it's even possible to envision all of the variations of suits filed or people who might file.
It has been said in other circumstances that no matter what the legislature does, lawsuits will probably follow because there are, after all, 300,000 or so PERS participants and almost 1,000 PERS employers. And no matter what you do, it's almost bound that someone is going to be unhappy with what you did. So I don't think avoidance of suit is necessarily the prime motivator. But as you are all aware, I mean, there is a substantial body of law out there about what the Supreme Court believes are contract rights, and obviously that I'm sure the legislature will be mindful of that body of law as you move forward. So I'd be happy to talk more about the actuarial contract issues or not, as is your preference. You let me know.
Thank you, Senator. Pretty much there.
I mean, I think it's kind of in my mind a point. We could talk about the contract issue, but you're really going to be presenting your legal arguments that you might present to the Supreme Court as to why one argument.
Not necessarily, Senator. If I may, I've tried to think about how to present this in a way which might make it more accessible. So I'm not really intending to make a legal argument, and this is not the place to make legal arguments. That's a lot of fun. But so if you'd like to give me a couple minutes, I'll try to run through it and perhaps give you some sense of perhaps a different way of thinking about at least the actuarial issue than perhaps has been the case. PERS is a defined benefit plan, and by that I mean it defines a benefit at the end of the day that you're going to get when you retire. It's not a defined contribution plan, and that's crucial to the analysis. If we take the classic full formula approach, which is a very, very standard defined benefit kind of approach. You know, and it provides that at the end of your career, you get your final average salary times your years of service times 1.67%. That's a very classic defined benefit kind of approach. Now, if you think back, that was that formula was adopted by the legislature and put into the statute in 1982. And at that time, the actuarial assumptions, in other words, the assumption the legislature would have made about how long people were going to live, would have been these infamous 1978 assumptions that we've all heard about. Now, if you think about that, what that means is today, when an individual retires on that classic defined benefit formula, we would all agree that on average people are going to live longer and it's going to be more expensive to pay out that benefit. Now, question, given that fact, do you think the legislature could go in and say, well, look, back in 82 when we passed 1.67, we thought people lived about 12 years after they retired. Now they live about 15. So maybe we ought to drop that 1.67 down to 1.5. Now, I trust all of you would say, well, wait a minute, I don't think we can do that. And at least I hope you'd all say that. I hate to plant a seed where I shouldn't have planted a seed. But that really would be the classic defined benefit analysis. And you'd say, well, I don't think we can do that. Now, ask yourself, money match is really the key benefit in the PERS plan now, and it's the key benefit when we start talking about actuarial factors, because they're not terribly important in the classic full formula. Now ask yourself whether that sheet of actuarial factors, are they really the same as that 1.67%? In other words, are they as unchangeable as we might all agree the 1.67% is? Now, if you look back historically, the PERS Board has certainly treated them that way. At least for the last 25 years or thereabouts, the PERS Board has taken the position that we cannot change those factors. They said we can change them in one direction. We can change them if they create a little higher benefit, but we cannot lower them. So, in effect, they have treated those factors almost as if they were the same as the 1.67%. And that's kind of the classic contract analysis that you look at and say, that's in fact what we've been doing. Now, why has the PERS Board done that? I don't have access to all their legal opinions, so I have to speculate a little bit here. But I've been doing this for a while. But I think the things that drove them to that were consideration of contract rights, making certain that the plan continued to be a qualified plan under the Internal Revenue Code. And also, I'm hoping this body is aware of the fact that there's some litigation back in 78 which led to a federal district court injunction, which is still in place, which has an impact on those tables. It required the use of mail-only tables. And I think that was mentioned in the correspondence that I think was shared with your committee some time ago that I had written to the board about. So if you look at it that way, notice we think about it that way, you can see that there is a logic to why these would be contractual. Now, if you go all the way, that's one extreme, if you will. That's the fixed. It's kind of the idea when you join the system, we're going to hang a set of actuarial assumptions on your lapel, and that's going to be your assumption throughout your entire career. If you go to the other end of the extreme and say, well, wait a minute, maybe actuarial assumptions really ought to be applied at the date of retirement. In other words, you don't find out what your assumptions are until the end of your career. The day you retire, we say, look, whatever's current. That's really a defined contribution approach. And there was in defined contribution plans, 401k plans, classic example. If you look at the structure of those plans are not designed to create a monthly benefit or a yearly benefit. They're designed to create a pot of money. Now, how you spend that pot of money is up to you. You can buy an annuity, you can take it, you can do whatever. But there is a different kind of plan for defined contribution. I think there's a tremendous difficulty with considering actuarial factors and money match to be used in that fashion, because money match is not defined contribution. It remains defined benefit under the law. I think if you were to go to that system, you have problems with the Internal Revenue Code, you have problems with contract, and a variety of other issues. Now, the PERS Coalition has adopted neither of those two positions, and we have not advocated either before the PERS Board nor before your committee or nor before the House either of those. We've really looked for something in the middle, and what we have come up with were two somewhat different options. At the PERS Board, we talked about the use of what we call the multiple segment approach, and what that is saying, look, we understand that there's a need to go to updated tables at some point. Maybe that ought to happen every 10 years or every 5 years or how often. But you should protect the benefits which have been earned during each segment so that the day an employee gets to retirement, they may have six different actuarial factors, each of which is attached to a different segment of their service. The PERS Board took a little different approach than that. They came up with what I call the accrued benefits approach, because they really adopted a concept from the private sector and said, we're going to do a little different, because the way we're going to do it is we're going to say, look, the day we change the actuarial factors, we will protect the benefits you have accrued, but that includes not only the amount of your account, but it includes the interest that you will earn on that money, not new money, just that money up until the time of your retirement. Frankly, fairly similar. It gets a fairly similar result to what we had originally opposed. What we had originally suggested as the correct approach. And so we supported that, and we said that's fine. It's different from what we thought was the best way, but it's pretty close, and we support it. We think either of those two approaches, arguably, are very consistent with contract rights, don't have any problem at all with Internal Revenue Code, and we would urge this committee at the end of the day to think about one of those two approaches. Now, the way the bill is currently structured is neither of those, because what it does is say, on the day that we're going to institute these new actuarial factors, we will take your account balance and we will freeze it. Doesn't earn anything. And if you're 5 years from retirement, then when you get to retirement age, we'll take your old account balance, the old factors, we'll calculate up your pension, and then we'll look at your new account balance based on your entire length of service and new factors, and you'll get the best of those two. I'm not saying that from a policy point of view that's necessarily a terrible choice. The problem is it doesn't match any recognizable theory of contract rights or pension benefit rights that I know of in either the public or private sector. So in other words, when you go to that system, perhaps from a policy point of view, you can say this seems a reasonable compromise, but yet if it is to be challenged, and I think we all agree almost everything's going to get challenged that happens in this session, it really doesn't give the Supreme Court a place to go which is a recognized theory of the protection of contract benefits. So if you do decide to go that route, you do decide to go the freeze rather than one of the others, you're placing a more daunting task, you're taking up a more daunting task, because you're really asking the court, what is it they say in Star Trek, to go where no one has gone before.
Well, Mr. Chairman, aren't we really in that sense defending to some degree what Lipscomb said? In a sense that he, if I read it correctly, looked at the statutory language and implied by that that they did have flexibility to have implemented actuarial tables but failed to do so.
Let me, two things about Judge Lipscomb. And I have to say this, and I don't think Judge Lipscomb was correct in his analysis, but I mean that'll be sorted out as we go through the courts. But the other thing is, what Judge Lipscomb said was not ultimately very clear. Now, he used the term full and immediate implementation. When during the course of the proceedings, and I don't as yet have this transcript, so I can't share it with you. I will the minute I have it. Steve Bouchon, the Assistant Attorney General, challenged whether it was appropriate for him to make that statement for some technical reasons, saying it was in the form of a declaratory judgment, which didn't belong in there. And then he went on and said, and besides that, Judge, we don't know what you mean, and the purse board has to understand what you mean by full and immediate. Can you help us understand what you mean? And the judge said, and again, I wish I had his exact words. I think what he said was, I'm not sure. I'm just trying to tell them to do the right thing. And so, I mean, I appreciate what Judge Lipscomb said, and clearly he believes there is some flexibility, but I think in the long run, his opinion is not all that helpful in giving us very specific direction about what is the right thing to do. So, now I know Bill Gary would say he believes full and immediate means yesterday, and that's fine. I mean, he's advocating for his position. I respect that, but exactly what Judge Lipscomb meant, in my mind, is somewhat up in the air. So, even if the legislature were not involved, and if we were heading back to the purse board and we were now going to say, okay, what did Judge Lipscomb want us to do, I believe we'd all be scratching our head to a certain degree, and again with various people saying the right thing to do is X, Y, or Z, and we'd be back to where we are. And the other thing I'd point out to you is the purse board did study this issue extensively, probably more extensively than any issue I've seen them study in the last 2 years, and they reached the conclusion that their accrued benefits approach was what they believed to be the best approach, consistent with contract rights, preserving the Internal Revenue Code or the qualified status of the plan, and so forth and so on. I do know that the opinions upon which they based that have been made available to certain members of the House committee. I don't know if they've been made available to members of your committee, but they're certainly accessible because apparently the Attorney General has taken the position that the legislature is in effect a plan sponsor and therefore is entitled to review those opinions. So I would strongly urge you, since you have an interest obviously in this issue and getting into the intricacies, to review those. They are available, but not available to me, but they are available to members of the committee, presumably to members of the legislature. So.
All right. A tangential question. Is Judge Lipscomb a candidate for the Supreme Court appointment process?
Yes. Yes, he is one of, I believe, 10 who have been rated highly qualified, which is the bar's highest qualification.
If he was appointed, do you know whether he would have to recuse himself?
Yes. When that's come up in other cases, judges have recused themselves, so he would not sit on any determination of what he did down below.
All right. Thank you.
So we could get a 3-3.
You could conceivably get a 3-3. And the other thing I have to say is that...
This will fulfill the Mark Johnson quote about, I don't know if I'm right or wrong, I'll be dead by the time we get them all figured out anyway.
Right, that's the advantage of being an actuary. And the other thing I should say to you is, in addition to some very challenging purse issues in the Lipscomb case, there were some very challenging administrative procedure issues, and it's entirely possible that in some degrees the Supreme Court could say that the judge applied the wrong means of analysis and send it back down to the judge without necessarily deciding the underlying substantive question. So I've said to several people, now don't assume that, you know, when the Supreme Court rules a year from now, that we will necessarily have answers to all our questions. We might, but it's entirely possible that they would say, no, we think you used the wrong method of analysis, Judge. You reanalyze these issues in light of what we now tell you is the correct, and then if anybody doesn't like your result, that can come back up to us again. So that is a possible outcome. I hope it's not the outcome. I hope the court, if they find that Judge Lipscomb used the wrong method of analyzing, goes right ahead and does it themselves on what they think to be the correct way of analyzing, but it could happen.
Thank you very much,
thank you,
Mr. Hartman. That was very helpful. You know, Mr. Wojtko, I have one question for you, please. And keep in mind, I'm not an attorney.
I approach with trepidation, Chair.
This is an easy one, I think. Over and over again, I've heard that the PERS board has not shared the Attorney General opinions that have directed their behavior over a course of time. I don't know how far back that goes, frankly. I mean, I assume it could go back as far back as there's been a PERS board. But the, you know, some of the issues that have gotten us to where we are today probably, you know, would have resulted from AG opinions that they've received over the past 5 years or so. The question I have for you is not can we see those, because my understanding is that they're not allowing those to be seen. But my question to you is, how do we ask the PERS board for those? Because I'm wondering if anybody has from the legislature.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, you can make that request as simply as looking at me and asking for it. And I will work with the Attorney General to convey them to you, because I agree with Mr. Hartman. The Attorney General has instructed us that because the members of the legislature are considered plan sponsors and therefore part of the governing body of the pension system, they can see the and there are only two, not the history of the PERS. Let me correct that. There's two pieces of advice, I believe, that the PERS board has held in confidence, and can do so without breaking privilege. And the board's ultimate goal is to ensure that privilege is not broken, because as the exchange between Senator Menace and yourself and Mr. Hartman indicated, there are many options under, or many alternative futures under which the board might have to proceed through litigation without either action by the legislature on this issue, and would like to continue, I believe, to maintain privileged communications between itself and its lawyers with respect to the management of that litigation. So I believe that I do reflect the board's view that, and they voted on this multiple times and always concluded, a majority always concluded to continue to keep that attorney-client privilege intact. So I hope that was responsive to your question.
Well, I guess further I would just say consider the request made.
Yes, sir.
Senator Menace?
Well, Mr. Wojtko, I'm trying to it's such an incredibly complex question, but I don't know, have we had presentation with respect to what market changes would do to the $15 billion gap? And I'm trying to putting Lipscomb on a shelf and saying, okay, it's too hard for me to figure out, so let's figure out what the problem is and try to determine whether we can resolve it legislatively. And the problem one identified is the $15 billion hole that's projected out some 30 or 40 years. And the immediate question in my mind is, to what extent, if the stock markets and the equity markets begin to turn around and the U.S. economy changes, does that figure get smaller and smaller? And we may have had this conversation, but it's clearly not embedded in the forefront of my brain. So.
Chair Corcoran, Senator Minnis, on the two subjects, first of all, the effect of the capital markets and their ups and downs on the UAL, and what I would say more broadly is the financial footing or health of the pension system. We have, in fact, worked with the actuary. We have a model that looks out 5 years, because that's as far as you can look out and not have to start estimating other changes that affects the financial footing, like the demographics of the workforce and so on. And we have both to the PERS task force created by Governor Kitzhaber, as well as the one created by the Speaker on the other side of the Capitol, presented that information multiple times also to our board, so we're prepared to do that for this committee as well. The short answer is that it takes one very long, sustained, and substantial rally in the capital markets for just that action to get rid of the UAL. And if we don't meet our 8% per year bogey, if you will, the UAL will get worse. But I would be happy to present, and I can do so in the space of 4 or 5 slides, show you what the various scenarios might be. With respect to your second question, which I believe was Judge Lipscomb, and we also have to work with our board as well as with legislators who ask us about the various scenarios. And while I agree with Mr. Hartman that there are many and they could be varied, there are some simplifying lines in the sand, if you will. One of them is that if the legislature acts on 2004 or some version of it, that it will trump the Lipscomb policy point of view from this point forward, assuming that it survives a Supreme Court challenge. Then the Lipscomb decision, and I would defer to Mr. Hartman and Mr. Gary and any other lawyer who would like to speak up, since that statute was in existence at the time and Judge Lipscomb's rulings applied to it, there would still be a cleanup issue as to what was necessary to fix, change, or otherwise revise the 1996 to 2001 period. So there are some lines in the sand that I think legislative action could draw that would set us on a different course, but it doesn't necessarily, although 2003, and I agree with Mr. Hartman, does try to look back and resolve some of the backward-looking issues. I don't know if that was responsive.
No, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think it is. It is responsive, but I think to the extent that we start looking backward, we get into the contract discussion issue that becomes more troublesome to me. And I guess what I was trying to do is look at the $15 billion problem as a standalone problem, and to what extent would either management of personnel issues in the state government system affect that, if any. Or market changes, and to what extent would that change that? And I guess maybe having some discussion from the Treasurer's office. I assume you guys have had this with the Investment Council and others about.
In fact, we had an Investment Council meeting this morning, and I'd be happy to work with your staff to do a short presentation on exactly the issues you raised.
And I guess what I'd like to know is just exactly what is the problem we're trying to solve. Because I think to some degree, although I personally agree with the Lipscomb decision, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not on the Supreme Court, and I agree with Mr. Hartman, God only knows what they'll ultimately decide, whether they will decide. So as a legislature, I think we need to focus on the identification of the problem and to try to find a resolution or solutions to the problem, if possible.
Maybe we'll try to arrange a presentation next week then, Senator Minnis.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr. Foyko.
Thank you, Chair Coffin.
We will close the public hearing on 2004, and we will reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 724. Mr. Perry, thank you for your patience.
It's my first PERS discussion of the year, and I, you know, respect you guys for sitting through more of it than I did.
Yeah, might want to change the liquor license laws after to like 15 minutes.
I think it could make my topic sound more exciting. For the record, my name is Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Association, and here I was the one that requested the Dash 1 amendment, so I kind of wanted to lay out what our concerns are. Currently, somebody applying for a new liquor license, there's two kinds of licenses, an on-premise and an off-premise. Self-explanatory, if you got an off-premise, it's a grocery store. If you're on-premise, you consume on-the-spot beer, wine, or taverns and bars. One of the issues that we have under currently right now today is that if you're an off-premise or an existing on-premise being bought by somebody else, you get a 90-day temporary license. Okay, what is the commission authorizes that license? What is happening is because of budget cuts, staff changes, and everything else, they're pushing up against the end of that 90-day period, and so they're running out of temporary licenses. It hasn't happened a lot, but it's starting to happen more. And obviously not being able to serve alcohol when you've been serving alcohol can be very damaging to a business. If you're a new on-premise, meaning a new bar or tavern, you don't get a temporary license. And OLCC can correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but right now they're probably not getting licenses for 120 days, which is a long time that somebody's had a business investment to wait to open up their doors to make money. Hey, that being said, right now they're talking about cutting more licensing positions. So from a business standpoint, we're really worried about the ability to get the licenses approved for long-term business standpoint. Now, I'm not necessarily opposed to what the cities are doing here. I sympathize with their problems, but obviously anytime you talk about bumping those dates back in the process, it gives us from a business standpoint more concern on the other end that it's going to extend that even longer. So that's my concern with moving the date from 30 days to 60 days. So what we have said is I think 120 days is far too long to wait for an approval of a license, but I don't mind moving it back a couple of weeks, meaning 45 days. But from a business standpoint, I would like to say that the amendment is missing one very important word from our standpoint on the last it's on page 4. It says that the commission may extend a temporary license. What we were saying is if the commission gives you a temporary license and if OLCC is not allowed to finish their investigation in the 90 days, which is starting to happen, the director should be able to extend that another 30 days if they were not able to complete it in time. If that makes sense. So I don't mind giving them 45 days or another 2 weeks, but I think the director should be able to at least extend it another 30 days. This still doesn't address the problem for the guys that aren't getting a temporary license that are waiting 120 days today under the current system. So they could end up being hurt in this process by extending it 45 days. But I am sympathetic with what the cities and the neighborhood associations have, but I do understand that right now we don't feel we're getting our licenses approved on a timely basis. So that's kind of my concern. By moving those deadlines back, I think you kind of move the license process back. So that's my rhetorical stylings for the day.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I had to step out of the room earlier when OLCC was testifying. And did they address the issue that you just talked about, Mr. Perry, the delay in the licensing and why it's taking them so long? And one amendment.
Chairman Corcoran, Senator Walker, I missed part of theirs too.
Why don't we just bring Mr. Steuben call up? He's here.
Yes, he is. Wayne back.
You don't mind, Mr. Perry?
I'd like to know why
you're the chair.
There's a delay.
Well, I don't want you guys to engage in fisticuffs here.
Oh, I don't think so. Mr. Chair, members, John Steuben from OLCC. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we historically have had a goal of 30 days of to issue a new liquor license once it reaches our desk. Due to state budget cuts, the uncertainty over PERS, which has forced a significant number of retirements in our shop, that timeline has been extended beyond our comfort level, frankly. I think at this point we're actually running about 90 days on average for the issuance of a new license. I would point out, as Mr. Perry did, that under the governor's proposed budget, we're slated to take more cuts in that area, and we would continue to have concerns over our ability to promptly issue a timeline, given the staffing levels we're looking at.
And follow-up question then, did you respond earlier, and I just missed that, about your opinion of the Dash 1 amendments? Or have you addressed them?
No, I haven't. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I have not addressed them. Certainly the pieces of the amendment that deal with the extension of the temporary authority to operate, we would see that as no problem from our perspective. Frankly, I think we would take the city's lead on the specific days involved, since this is a process that really impacts local government rather than the OLCC specifically. I mean, I think globally our view of this bill is we looked at it as a way to improve the relationship between local governments and the state in the liquor licensing process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Mr. Chair, it looks to me like we're either going to split the baby or they're going to kind of duke it out themselves.
Well, the one idea that I wanted to ask Mr. Perry about I talked to the League of Cities a little bit about this, and I wondered, I just wanted to try it out on you. And in listening to the concerns that the League of Cities had, one issue that they raised that I thought was reasonable was that this isn't a one type deal. You have from the very simple to the very complex in terms of multi-state, multi-owner kind of situations. And what the cities have said, I'm not so much sympathetic to their argument about the community groups, because of their timing. I don't think we should be holding up business unnecessarily because of that. But there did seem to be a solid rationale that it is much more complex to do, a multi-state restaurant chain, just for example, since that's your area of expertise, with multiple owners, for instance, and to cut them some slack. Would there be any ability to look at an amendment that would say, in the case of in-state or in-state ownership, that we would have one set of criteria, and in the state of multi-state or multi-owner, we could have another criteria?
Mr. Chairman, the issue really is for the off or the on-premise ones that cannot get a license. I mean, what you're doing is you're investing in a business and basically not opening. And so, really, from my standpoint, it's not necessarily the comment period, it's my ability to get the license. And so anytime you extend any part of that timeline out, it's going to make it harder to reach the target date of getting a license on time on the end. So, I mean, if for some reason I get some insurance that they had a license within 90 days or they could have a license within a certain period of time, I might feel differently. But as of right now, and like I said, this has nothing to do with the cities. I understand that they've got in a difficult position, but right now I'm not getting licenses in a timely manner. Right. And there's nothing that shows me that timeline's going to speed up when you look at the budget process. Mm-hmm. So moving that date out is just, it's going to put people trying to open their businesses in jeopardy right now. I mean, if you come back in 2 years and the budget's fixed and we all have a great time, it's a different story. But as of right now, they're not meeting timelines today. So anytime you shove that date out, it's just going to put us at concern, whether it's a local or a multi-chained. Like I said, I'm sympathetic with where they're coming from. I just, at this point, I'm not getting licenses on a timely manner, so that's our concern.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
Well, I had actually one.
Senator Walker?
And it's probably going to be addressed to Mr. Steubenbaugh, who went to the back of the room again. And it was on page 3 of the amendments in subsection 6, line 8. It's changing licensee to person. And I'm just kind of curious, is there someone besides a person who can ever apply for a license? And what, is that a nuance of LC, or what's going on here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I believe the reason that change was made was, I believe that's just a cleanup of the statute.
Okay.
Because it's in this context, a licensee is a person. But it says an application for issuance or renewal. In this case, a licensee is a person who already has a license, mm-hmm. so a licensee cannot
file an application for a new license. So I believe it's just a cleanup of the statute.
Okay.
Is that the way you read it?
Yeah, actually, there were two different. This is Bill Perry again. There were two different. There was a temporary standard and a new license standard and a renewal standard. And so that one only dealt with renewals. They were all already a licensee. What this bill does is combine the two standards. So, I mean, that's why they needed the change, was my understanding. And I'm practicing law without a license. Okay, there.
Okay. Likewise.
I'm listening to law without a license. Okay.
I was just wondering if all these people could go out in the hallway and figure it out.
Well, I was going to suggest that in a roundabout way and see if maybe we'll just close the public hearing and hold this on, see if you guys could have a little bit of conversation about this, and then we can poll the members of the committee and see where they are as well. But
like I said, the only problem that I have, Bill Perry, once again, with the dash one amendments, was it should say director has the authority to extend the license, not the commission. Because that's the problem we have today, is when the license runs out, you have to go back to the commission, and sometimes you'll have a week or two of dead time. So.
I see. So you had a technical change you wanted to make anyway. So
yeah, even with this, I'll need a dash two amendments if the committee so chooses to adopt my concept. So.
Okay. Well, I think we'll leave it at asking you to have a discussion with the cities and OLCC and see if there's something to be brokered there. That would be great.
Like always, I just take orders from you, Mr. Chairman.
Closed. Okay. We have one more little bill. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 692. Would you let us know what that does, Mr. Ellsworth?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 692 authorizes governing bodies of counties with the consent of the treasurer to make service districts directly responsible for managing monies of the service district. We have also attached with this a dash one amendment, which changes and narrows some of this.
Okay. We have Gerald Kubiak from Washington County. I've been informed by an unnamed party in the room that I'm to treat him nicely because this is his first time testifying. I'm not quite sure if I'll take that advice or not, but we'll see.
Evidently, I've got friends in good places, yes. I appreciate that. Thank you, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. Gerald Kubiak, Washington County. Indeed, first time testifying. Let's see. Of course, Washington County staff here present before you, and we have a relatively unique situation with Washington County in that the County Board of Commissioners serves also as the Board of Directors for a county special district, and that's our Clean Water Services Agency, which provides wastewater, stormwater, flood management services, fish habitat, and a range of other services to urban Washington County residents. It's about 450,000 folks. I should note as well that in addition to my role with the county representing them in the legislative forum and other forums, I do represent Clean Water Services on an informal basis. The two agencies are sort of sister agencies. We, in addition to sharing a common governing body, we're co-located in the same facility, and we have a close working relationship. But the bottom line is that we are separate agencies, which kind of gets at the heart of the issue that has prompted us to pursue this bill, and that is that per state law, the county is required to perform treasury functions for Clean Water Services Agency. And those, as you're probably well aware, treasury activities generally are money management. That includes investments, cash management, managing credit cards, and so on and so forth. The real issue is that the Board of Commissioners / Board of Directors has discerned that it's not necessarily efficient or practical any longer for the county to perform those functions for Clean Water Services. It's a sophisticated agency with easily sufficient capacity administratively to do its own treasury services. That's where we get to the nature of this bill, is that statute presently requires, as I think I've said, that the county perform those functions for Clean Water Services. What we are seeking here is really a statutory change to bring that matter back to the local governing body for determination. Senate Bill 692 would authorize the governing body of the district, when in fact that governing body is also the Board of Commissioners, to authorize the district to perform its own treasury functions. I guess it's our sense that it's appropriate that the local officials.
You've done a very good job, Mr. Kubiak.
Can you explain what the amendments do?
Yes, I will do that. I will cut right to the chase. The bill, as initially drafted, didn't necessarily address the issue the way we'd anticipated or desired, and so the changes that are made by the Dash 1s here do two things. They clarify that the consent of the county treasurer to make this change is required only if it's an elected treasurer, and two, that an officer or an employee of the district is going to assume treasury responsibilities.
Thank you.
I'd be happy to answer further questions. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. We'll close the work session. Close the public hearing. Open the work session on Senate Bill 692.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menas.
Move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments.
Senator Menas moves the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 692. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. Senator Menas.
Move Senate Bill 692 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Menas moves Senate Bill 692 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, I'm not so sure, Mr. Chair. The testimony just wasn't very clear. I'm not sure this bill's really been explained. We could use another hour on it, maybe.
Okay, we will set up a meeting. Mr. Kubiak, I'd like you to meet with Senator Walker at 6:30 tomorrow morning, please, for an hour. And
2004.
Yeah. Mr. Gravel, would you call the roll, please, so we can get out of here?
Senator Stark?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 692 had passed to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and Senator Scar will carry it, please. Thanks very much. We are closed, and we are adjourned. Thank you, panel.